First, let me just take this opportunity to say to everybody, thank you so much. This is our last session, and I'm both grateful and disappointed in the exact same amount that it's our last session. It's been wonderful, and I'm so grateful to all the people who have presented, and as grateful to all the people who have been active and committed and sincere participants. I think that is what makes the Spring Institute the Spring Institute, and I've really been impressed and enlivened and moved by the extent to which you all are engaging with each other during breaks and lunch, but also during the session, so thank you very much. So this is our ultimate session, and the person who will chair it is Maria Pilar Aquino, who teaches here, the professor of theology and religious studies here in our department at the University of San Diego. We are very lucky to have her because she is also a past visiting professor of theology at Harvard Divinity School, but we've already heard back. She is author, editor, and co-editor of 12 books and has published numerous book chapters and essays which focus on religious interventions for social transformation from the perspective of feminist theologies of liberation. And we are lucky to have one of those articles in our packet. So thank you, Fla.
Thank you, Sarah. I want to thank Sarah for inviting me to chair this panel on the topic migrant outreach in San Diego's canyons. We will be hearing not just about the San Diego canyons, we will hear about other experiences as well. So I am honored to share this panel with two wonderful leaders of elite theology of liberation in the context of migration in the borderlands. I'm sure that the site visit to the U.S. border wall done yesterday offered a great opportunity to take a closer look at the context for this Spring Institute. I am the daughter of a migrant Bracero family. Coming from Nayarit, Mexico, in 1964, my family settled in San Luis, Sonora, Mexico. This is the joint border city with San Luis, Arizona, where Sister Chavez was born. In that setting of farm workers' activism, my father became a member of La Causa since its early years, since the La Causa was founded in the year 1962. During my younger years, along with my mother and my sisters, I spent many summers with other farm workers lifting and cleaning lettuce and tomato in the fields of Arizona in California. That's what we did in the fields. Both my personal experiences of growing up in the borderlands and my interest of thinking about them in critical feminist theological terms enable me to understand and make my own the many hardships people endure along the border due to poverty and marginalization, not to mention desert conditions and often blazing heat, as it was our setting in San Luis, Arizona, in the heat, for those of you who know the desert area, so that's the area in which I grew up. As a context for this Spring Institute, so ably convened by Sarah, the San Diego-Tijuana region offers a unique opportunity to appreciate the many dimensions and levels involved in the relationship between theology, migration, and the borderlands. This border area has developed into a unique, dynamic, and luring geopolitical location in which literally one can touch, sense and experience the deep inequalities between the dominant first world or geopolitical north and the subordinate two-thirds world or geopolitical south. As a distinctive feature of this border region, migration has fashioned binational communities that must learn to recognize and integrate the complex dynamics of socio-cultural interactions as a means to bettering our shared living conditions. Along this binational border, the San Diego-Tijuana region has become the largest population center with an estimated 6 million inhabitants. The San Isidro port of entry is the busiest territorial border crossing in the world. Located fewer than 20 miles south of downtown San Diego, this border station processes more than 150,000 crossings of people daily, including nearly 50,000 vehicles. Although U.S. residents travel to Mexico for employment, shopping, and entertainment, Mexican residents traveling for work comprise nearly 60% of crossings from Tijuana into the larger San Diego. The constant flow of people and services between the two countries both strengthens borderlands interactions and raises issues that affect the living conditions of those who share this common space. This panel will address some of the initiatives that social and faith-based actors have devised in response to the concerns involved in this border region. Two great panelists will give us a picture of inspiring and courageous interventions for social justice, Elaine Elliott and Reverend Bill Radatz. Let me say a few words about each of them. Elaine Elliott. Elaine, she will address the topic understanding migration through personal encounters. Elaine grew up in Oaxaca, Mexico, where her parents, members of the Wycliffe Bible Translators, served as educators and healthcare workers in an indigenous village of Oaxaca. She is a historian by training and a development expert by vocation. After graduating from the University of Arizona in 1974, she and her husband, a very dear friend of mine, Steve Elliott, moved to Guatemala, where they established a nonprofit in the Guatemalan highlands. The nonprofit, called Ishil Fund, supported local leadership for projects in bilingual education, healthcare, microcredit, and an expert business of their distinctive weaving. As the civil war in the country continued, eventually resulting in the massacre of over 400 villages and deaths of about 200,000 and displacement of 1 million people, the nonprofit engaged in emergency supply of clothing, food, temporary shelter, and medical care. Elaine translated the novel of a Mayan author published in English as A Mayan Life. After being in Guatemala for 17 years, Elaine returned to the United States in 1991 and began working at the University of San Diego, where she also completed her MA in history. Elaine has served as director of the USD Center for Community Service Learning since 2002. She worked at USD from 1992 to 1995 on diversity and inclusion, and then collaborated to build the Community Service Program, which is now nationally recognized for its excellence in student leadership development, community partnership, and teaching on social justice. Elaine has just completed 18 years of work at USD and will soon be returning to Guatemala. Let me say a few words about Reverend Bill Radatz. He will address a topic which, in spite of being at the core of migration dynamics, is seldom discussed in connection to issues of religion, migration, and the borderlands. This is about torture survivors. He will speak about caring for torture survivors among us. Bill Radatz is a retired pastor with the Evangelical Lutheran Church in America, or ELCA, or ELCA. He is one of the founders of Survivors of Torture International in 1997 here in San Diego, and has served on their board for 12 years. This independent nonprofit organization is dedicated to caring for survivors of politically motivated torture and their families who live in San Diego County. Survivors empowers torture survivors to reclaim their strength and vitality so that, recover their strength and vitality that were stolen from them by brutal dictators and governments. Pastor Radatz has also shared the immigration border concern ministry team of the Pacific Casino of the ELCA for the past 10 years and has worked as a director of the San Diego Presbyterian Crisis Center. His passion for immigration and refugee issues stems from his time as a missionary in Peru, where he and his family lived and worked with the Quechua-speaking people of the Andean mountains from 1984 to 1989. So with these two wonderful people, we will hear about their experiences and thoughts about the theme of this institute. And then once we hear from them, we will engage in a fruitful conversation. Shall we begin with Elaine?
And thank you, Pilar. That was really, really very gracious. And as you can see from my personal biography, why I care so much about this issue of immigration. And in terms of our theme of lived theology, I want to introduce, I know some of you met them already, but Mike Akame, Pastoria Wellenetro, because they are key people who created this connection to the migrant workers in the canyons of North County, which has the parish has worked for 20 years. Is that right? 25. Every Sunday, 80 people from the parish, I think. So it's parsed out consistently, having this ministry. So really the two real deep lived theology experts on this issue, I feel like we have right here. And very glad they're here and maybe can talk more once we get to that point. I will say my piece, which is I've really appreciated the chance to learn more theology, and I really should read some of your 12 books. And Rolando's too. But I've been in a position as the director of community service here to connect students to a lot of different issues in the community. And so the migration issue is one, and part of our job is to do it through classes, but it's also to do it through social justice events. Mm-hmm. So we've hosted films, like the film that you shared, Juan Carlos Films. I think this is his fourth film, and we've showed all of his films with panels. We've done conferences on this issue. We've done two conferences on Strangers No Longer. And Sister Barb, who's there in the back, has this wonderful way of creating dialogue around a panel where she brings different people together, like people who are talking about, like a Border Patrol agent, a human rights activist, somebody who crossed the border, someone who is a grower, and they have a dialogue and then theological reflection surrounding all of this, and people engage. So there have been a lot of different programmatic things, and then we try to take students with us to activist events in the community. And as I was reflecting on these activist events, I hadn't really thought about this so much before, but they've all been pretty much coming from this Christian theological perspective where they have had the image of Christ is in the migrant. And it's over and over in so many different ways. For example, the first one I went to when I first came to San Diego was a march from Christ the King Church to that cemetery that's near there. You would know the name of it, I've forgotten. And there are all these 60 paupers' graves, and we had prayers over these graves, so many of which are migrants. And in the prayers, some reference was made to Christ being buried in a borrowed tomb, even in that context. And then this Posada Sin Fronteras, which some of you went to see on the edge, always uses the theme of Mary and Joseph looking for a place to stay. And so they sing the traditional song from the Mexican side saying, we're looking for a place to stay. And then the American side says, no, sorry, we can't take you in. And so the theme also comes in the Invisible Chapel film. And I was there on the day when, after all these years, this place had been constructed by the migrant workers themselves. And because of a lawsuit brought against the owner of the property and Pastoria knows all the details, and the Minutemen going after these guys and ruining the places where they live, they finally were having to tear it down. And it was a very deeply sad day. And yet the priest in his comments, it was on Epiphany, and he said these Minutemen and people like this are like Herod, who can't see the Christ child in Christ in you. And I was thinking, the people like from the parish of Our Lady of Mount Carmel are much more like the Magi, who've done a great job seeing Christ in these men and bringing boots, blankets, sleeping bags, food, and also bringing medicine and other things that they need. Another example is Rosemary Johnston is the coordinator of the Interfaith Coalition for Immigrant Rights, and it carries on a lot of different activities. And the first time I heard her speak it here at USD, she referenced that little weird yellow sign that you can see of people running across the freeway. You know, the parents, two parents are dragging this little kid to warn him not to run migrants over. And she, Matt, said that this is an image of the Holy Family. So I've had this theme that has come up for me a great deal of seeing Christ in the Stations of the Cross have been done for migrants. The crosses that are on the border fence are explicitly with people's names and so on. But for our students, these activist events have one level of teaching, but the thing that transforms them the most, I think, is the personal encounter. And so we have two real spaces of personal encounter. And one is the Casa del Migrante across the border, where they're able to share a meal with the migrants, they're able to hear their stories, they're able to just be part of it. In the past, they cooked meals, but they don't need us, they have too many volunteers, they just go eat, which I've had to assure them is a form of accompaniment, that's what people who are in this traumatic situation actually need. That is a form of service, to be available to listen and to share, so that they are like, you know, we're not making anything, you know, no, understand that's a form of service, to be present. And then, most amazingly, this opportunity to go to the Sunday morning mass up in North County, where basically they have the chance to help work with the migrants, to hear, help them with their English a little bit. And as Christoria and I were saying, the students probably learn more than from the encounter than the men actually learn English, but the intention is there. And then they hear mass in Spanish and share a meal together. And I was so struck, one of our classes that had nothing to do with migration, but it was about a sociology of, you know, urban issues. The professor had them going there, and he really wasn't trying to teach theology at all, really. But I was so amazed in the reflections that came out of the blogs that the students were doing, because he had them blogging online as well as doing class discussion. And I just read the blogs, and I was like, oh my goodness, these students have spontaneously come up with the themes from the pastoral letter, Strangers No Longer. The U.S.-Mexican bishops put together this letter, which basically, in part of it, has the thesis, you have a right to an opportunity in your own homeland. If you can't find it there, you have a right to migrate, to seek opportunity. Nations have a right to defend their borders, but you, as a wealthy nation, have a responsibility to consider taking in, you know, those who need to seek opportunity, and that the human dignity of people should be respected. Now, our students, the majority are relatively affluent. They probably come from families, most of which fit the stereotype of not being very positive toward immigrant or migration issues. And so we're challenging them. So this is a kind of pedagogy of the oppressor, to do service learning and to get them in that environment where they're meeting somebody personally that may have the opportunity to change them. And it was so obvious that these encounters have had that opportunity. So I'm just going to read a couple student quotes. I got way more, but you know, there's just a few to just give you a flavor. You know, one student at the beginning of the semester said, what should we do? Do we build a huge fence? Do we reform our citizenship requirements? And if so, how? Do we let illegal immigrants who have lived here stay? What about their children? Since I can't speak from personal experience of what it's like to flee my home in search of more opportunities, I'd like to put a face on this issue of immigration and factor that into my opinion. Mm-hmm. But what people encountered then, as they encountered the stories of these men, is like, oh my goodness, there really isn't opportunity in their homeland. They are willing to put up with being away from their families, painfully living in a canyon where they don't get much, you know, where it's painful to live. How bad must it be back there that it's worth it to do this? And then quotes about, this is worth it to me, a man saying, this is worth it to me so that my family, you know, can have a decent life. And so it says, he says, when you see individuals, it really, this is a student speaking again. When you see individuals, do I need water? Thank you, Christoria. When you see individuals, it really changes your perspective. In the media, you just hear that illegal immigrants are taking our jobs and things like that. But when I visited them, I found out that most of them are sacrificing almost everything for their families. They told us of how they haven't seen their kids for months and missed them so much. Hearing and seeing these things made me change my perspective on the immigration and how we as a country view it. Mm-hmm. And then they also begin to be aware of, so as I was saying, that, you know, how unreceptive our country is, that we have a responsibility if people are in this dire economic situation and they have a right to seek employment and they're just trying to come here to do good work. And they all acknowledge it. One young man said, is like, who is anti-immigrant, he's like, we're just obviously coming here trying to make it, you know. And it said, this country despises the inflow of migrants but has no problem putting them to work and looking the other way. All these people wanted was to come to this country for what it stands for, life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. It is shameful, though, that as Americans, we hold these words in high regard, but only for other Americans. I hope to one day be able to break the ideas impressed in our mind by our government about despising and not helping migrants and treat them like the equal children of God they are. And so the thing that is most important is this respect for human dignity. And I do have to read a couple of those because it's just deeply touching, because what part of service learning is setting up situations where people have an encounter across a social barrier they would otherwise not have that personal encounter. And now they've gotten to the point where talking that they, some of this semester they've been going out and having some pizza parties. It's kind of interesting. I'm not sure how much we want to encourage that, but that's okay. So it says things like, one of the things that happened when the Invisible Chapel was torn down was that they had to camp out different places to try to find a new place to meet, and finally are being hosted in this orchid place, and right next to it there's this pet hotel. So the students said, I know I mentioned this last week to a few of you, but does anyone else want to share their ideas on an animal resort next to the flower shop where we meet? What a strange contrast. Right next to the place where impoverished homeless men meet once a week to scrape together some sense of community is a resort for pets. I don't know for sure, but I think that's like a luxury hotel for your dog. Another student wrote, joined in, I wonder how the migrants feel about it. I mean, here they are working their butts off with no luxuries, and then there's this pet resort where dogs, cats, and other species are being treated like royalty. I think it shows how backward our nation can be sometimes. They put resorts up for animals before they help a migrant or another human being. So I think it would be interesting to ask a migrant about his view on this. And then there was a fire in the canyon, and the students were all worried what had happened to the migrants in the fire. Does anyone know if it was near where the migrants lived? The guy on the radio said no structures were damaged, but I almost wonder if the makeshift homes would be considered structures. And so as they became intimate with the migrants, they began to just have that, I'm getting closer to seeing what life is like from your point of view. One person wrote, I really cannot even imagine what it's like living in their shoes and facing the problems they face. I respect them, however, for getting up every morning and making something happen. I feel like if I were put in their shoes, I'd want to throw up my hands and give up. I have admiration for their light spirits. I'm surprised each time. And so, in conclusion, one of the students said, you know, now that I have faces of migrants that I've helped, in my mind, it makes it extremely difficult for me to be really harsh on the issue. And so that pedagogy works. It's a transformational moment, and it fits with what we're saying of how can heart and head can go together. And so one little conclusion that I had in thinking about these spaces is I've done lots of going across the border, taking students to encounter things across there, and lots of border waits, and how for me, I really resonated with John's comment of crossing the border as a spiritual discipline, because for me it has been a place to meditate and think, what does this mean? It's almost like beautiful creation, sin, fall, death, hope for future redemption, all in this one little space, you know, just right there. And So I'm thinking about the talks that we've had. I feel like I have been in a personal process of trying to immigrate to the reign of God as Orlando expressed it, through this experience of, you know, crossing these borders. I have had that Eucharistic meal with the migrants up in the Canyon and also in the Casa del Migrante. And one of the conclusion I want to write, read a little reflection I wrote after a few years ago on Palm Sunday. There was the largest demonstration that San Diego County has ever seen, which was for immigration reform. There were 75,000 people. It was a beautiful sunny day. Lots of flags, you know, American, Mexican, Jamaican, any country, you know, flags and kids in strollers and grandparents, and it was actually lovely. And so after that walk, I just wrote something that I'll read to you as my conclusion. Flags wave as strings of people walk to celebrate and to supplicate, perhaps unknown to many, to commemorate your procession to Jerusalem. We do not know if we head to yet another crucifixion, but we do know that today is a real Palm Sunday. We see the Holy Family on the yellow warning signs on the freeway. We see the crucifixion in the 4,000 crosses on the border fence. We see your torment in the desert as people walk thirsty and hungry. But today is Palm Sunday, and we wave our flags, and we chant, and we are something more than ourselves as we walk down Broadway between the skyscrapers.
Thank you very much. Thank you, Elaine. I kind of heard the assignment for today being what you do with really big problems around immigration at a really concrete and local level. And I thought the best way in some ways to try to get that across would be story, and the story of this organization, which I'm intertwined, so it'll be personal in some ways too, from which I'll extract a few lessons I've learned along the way, and then invite you to extract lessons along the way too for what does this mean for other ways we could be responding. Mid-80s, I was a parish pastor in Minneapolis, Minnesota, got very involved with world hunger issues at that point, enough so that I was interested enough to let our church know that as I was starting to look for a new call, that I would be interested in an international call. And you get what you ask for sometimes. Church called us and said, we'd like to interview for this one place, Peru, up in the high mountains, the Andes Mountains, work with the Quechua Indians up there. This was a strange thing for us. I'd been out of the country to Mexico once and to Canada a few times. We didn't know Spanish. We didn't know Quechua, the language that the folks we would be working with. And we had a family with three kids, and they couldn't tell us where we were going to live and where our kids would go to school, all those kind of conditions. This is my evidence that there is a Holy Spirit, because we accepted and went with all that. And a very good experience. But it was also at a very tumultuous time in Peru's history. Several guerrilla groups, the Sendero Luminoso and Tupac Amaru, were essentially trying to bring down the government. And though we never personally felt violence against us as a family there, we heard lots of firsthand stories from people who had been tortured or who had been made to watch their spouses be tortured. And sometimes it was the guerrilla groups and sometimes it was the military group, and it was hard to tell who the good guys were and who the bad guys were. They would often dress up as each other in order to sort of trick people and turn their feelings against the other. So for me, it was really the place where, for me, I got a passion for immigrants. And to know that immigrating is not usually a first choice. You know, I want to go to a good place and have a new opportunity for life. It's usually the last choice. And it sometimes is as desperate as life and death. And in these cases, it often means having to abandon everything you know because of this threat of torture and being killed or having your family killed staying there. So I kind of came back to the United States with that passion and burden on me. Ended up in San Diego and ended up at a place called the Presbyterian Crisis Center. There were always some people who said, what kind of crisis do Presbyterians have? That they need a crisis center. But it was an emergency service center, food and rental system, a lot of things like that. And I know some of you said, but I thought you said you were a Lutheran pastor, Bill. Well, for 9 years, I was a Lutheran. I heard a call from both denominations to work together in the center that's in San Diego here. And seeing all kinds of folks, particularly people that were homeless and that, but among them immigrants. And our staff was discovering, as we were having sessions with immigrants that were coming for emergency services, began to hear some stories about people who said, I'm here because I've been tortured and I had to leave my home country. And you can imagine that inspires a great deal of compassion and empathy. So much so not only that we could do resources to help, but we said, well, we would like to go to court with you when you have your immigration hearing, you know, to be a moral support. And we get into court often, and the person being put before the judge would tell a different story than they told us sometimes in their offices. Or they wouldn't tell the judge things that we thought would have been critically important. And I hope, frankly, that we never communicated this to the clients we were seeing. But we would often get back as a staff and say, what's going on here? Now, are these people lying to us just to get free groceries from us here? And how could they hold such a story? So it was kind of in that atmosphere that one day the congregation I was worshiping with had a visitor looking for a new place for the congregation. Kathy Anderson is her name and her family. Kathy had served in El Salvador with the Peace Corps and had been on the board of Amnesty International. Amnesty had kind of notified her that they were hearing there were lots of folks here who were refugees from torture. And that they were encouraging her to look for opportunities to see if something couldn't start there. And you know, this isn't the kind of conversation you usually fall into on the first Sunday when somebody comes to visit your church, torture. But we somehow got into that discussion and found out some of the frustrations both of us were having in that. And eventually found one other Lutheran pastor here. Kathy is a layperson, a social worker at Grossmont Hospital at that time. George Falk, whose family is an immigrant family from World War II Germany under Hitler. And he, as a child, was made to watch people in their community being executed. So he had firsthand experiences of torture. So conversations from that led to us saying, what are the resources here? Doing some homework about, well, how many folks are here? And we began to do some reading and extracting numbers. We estimate at this point, we think conservatively, that in San Diego alone, there are about 11,000 refugees who are here because they've been tortured in their home countries and had to leave. And we found out there was really no resource in San Diego that was dedicated particularly to that purpose. There were good organizations like Catholic Charities, you know, that would provide counseling and provide emergency resources, but no one was focused on this issue and its consequences with people. So we began to think about starting an organization. None of us had ever started a 501c3 and began that process and found out it isn't too hard. We found an attorney who did things pro bono along the way and found out all you need is about $900 back then. I don't know what it is now. And we started Survivors of Torture International. We struggled with the title. First nominations were Survivors of Victims of Torture. And we decided that really is not it, because we are talking about people who are incredibly resilient, who have come through something that none of us have had to go through and have gotten to this point with that. And yes, there's a way in which you can say they've been victims, but we wanted to celebrate the fact that they were survivors and that they had learnings in life and strengths that we wanted to build upon. You know, with 11,000 folks here that are survivors of torture, it's an unknown quantity, partly because someone who's gone through that almost never is going to come up to you and say, hi, my name is, and I'm a survivor of torture, because they're trying to hide that from themselves. It is so painful in many ways for them, those memories, that they just want to push them aside. So rarely are we going to know that that's an ingredient that's happened to them. so often you'll be, you could be shopping with folks who are survivors of torture and not know that at all. So then we began to say, well, how do we begin to provide services to people here for that healing process with them? And we formed the organization with three missions in our, three purposes in our statement. One is to be a healing resource to survivors of torture and their families. Secondly was to educate the professional and general community. That was really important to us, and it really led to the way we decided to develop the organization. There's a network across our country, and in fact around the world, of torture treatment centers. Most of them stand independent, but are very intimately networked together. Kathy, our director, does almost monthly conference calls with the national network here. Many of them have chosen a model of in-house professionals, psychologists, psychiatrists, whatever else is needed to provide it. We chose a model instead of saying, we've got enormous resources in our community, let's seek out those people that are already in those places and see if we, if they would join with us in doing special training and be able to see clients either on a pro bono basis or for a small fee. And that's the model we've taken. So actually in our network, we celebrate that. Now there are probably over 100 professionals that are helping to provide services, and they are physicians, dentists, physical therapists, therapists who provide counseling, acupuncturists. That one always puzzled me. Someone who's gone through torture, acupuncture, needles, and yet many, many of our clients who have tried that have really found that to be very helpful. Translators are part of that network too. And interesting, as that organization developed, we learned that what can happen if you're a counselor and you begin to hear those cases over and over again, you begin to catch the trauma. It comes within you, and that great care is needed for the people who are providing those services. So in many ways, our staff, although we have a psychologist on our staff and they do part of the screening and are available, much of their time is spent nurturing and debriefing the people in our network so that they stay healthy as they're treating others, and that's tech we've taken. After we got things going, and it was feeling very good, I kind of went through a personal trauma in that, and that being intimately involved with this, and in some ways learning how deep the wounds of torture can be with people. I was beginning to say to myself, well, we've got professionals now, this should be left to the professionals, the people who really know how to deal with such trauma in their lives. I had lots of people come back at me, particularly Kathy Anderson at that point. And she said, you know, when you are giving groceries to those people at the crisis center and you're sitting in your office and teaching with them, you may be providing better therapy than the therapists that are here. And our model, too, has been very diverse. We know that Western model of therapy is not appreciated around the world, and a lot of people would see that as very strange. So we started early on to say, let's look at many models that we could use with people and learn from them as we go. We've defined ourselves through our entire history as a learning organization. That first year almost after we formed an organization, it was these three people and a few others that we got on our board who said, we need to teach ourselves first, and invited some incredible resource people that have been working in the area of torture for many years to come and teach us. And that's when I learned, much to my embarrassment, that person that I was mad at, because when they got in front of the judge, they didn't tell the same story, that, first of all, that torture can leave actual physical damage in the brain, often, with electric shocks and that. And then when you put someone who's gone through torture, usually, and particularly politically motivated torture, you bring them, you've got them in an office where you've got a trust relationship and they open up and they're able to talk. Then you take them in front of a judge in a courtroom, often with bars on the window, and with a guard that's standing there in uniform with a gun in his holster, and flashbacks just come back to those folks, and it begins to feel much like whatever the circumstance was that was threatening their life. And they literally forget, and they can't remember much of those stories. And I felt really bad in some ways of having those opinions along the way, but in some ways that's what we were able to learn from those folks in the treatment. Some of our learnings were by accident and kind of fun. I've told the story a couple times already to a few folks here that you may know that if you're here applying for asylum because you've been tortured in your home country and you fear that if you return, you face death or persecution, that you can apply for asylum. If you're granted asylum, at least before 9/11, it was the common practice that you would be released on your own volition and charged with preparing your case, given a case, court date where you bring your case to the judge. So you had the resources of the community to be able to use the internet and do research to prepare your own case. The U.S. government, however, does not allow you to work while you're in asylum, which seems kind of strange. We made this assumption when we first began Survivors that, you know, we're here on the southern border. Our clientele are going to be Central, South American, probably poor. And indeed, there have been people from there, but that's not the majority of our... We've served now folks from 60 countries. The highest majorities come from the Middle East and from Africa. Getting back to kind of accidentally how you discover sometimes how things work. We also have a social worker that can help provide, because we have to provide groceries sometimes for those folks because they're not allowed to work. Many of them are professionals who want to be here and want to work, and yet we say that they can't in that. That's why they got in trouble in their countries often. They're professional teachers or attorneys or doctors who spoke up about human rights and therefore were tortured because of that. But we found that our social worker went to the home of one of the young men from Africa, and just in talking with them, opened the cupboard, and here's about 5 boxes of mashed potatoes up there. And she said, "What, you don't like these?" You know, she'd been giving these in the food bags that we had been giving to the young man. And so, well, you know, I opened a box and tasted them, and they tasted terrible. Of course, he was tasting the raw, instant mashed potatoes. And, of course, we're reminded that in many African nations, the men don't do any of the cooking. So that led to our social worker saying, "Hey, what we need is a cooking class for the men." And that actually developed into a group that was remarkable. A bunch of men who would get together to learn cooking, all from different countries, most of them not speaking each other's language, having a few words in English they could exchange, and yet some of them have reflected back that as they look at things that helped them the most, it was that group. Knowing that they could be in a place with people who they know they didn't have to hide their experience from, that had gone through that and understood it, and that were learning a new survival technique together. And that was kind of one of those accidental. So in many ways, we took on new dynamics of group therapies, of starting a quilting group with the women and a cooking class with the men and a few things like that. We just, a couple months ago, passed our 1,000th client that we've seen here, which is bad news and good news. That's 1,000 people that are here among us that have been tortured. The good news, out of the 11,000, that's a significant number that have come to receive treatment. Our funding, of course, has grown over the time. Part of it has come through Office of Refugee Resettlement, where we and the other centers actually lobbied the federal government to say, this is an important area of treatment, and you need to set funds aside. And for 6 years, we received those grants. This, for reasons we've not yet understood, we were defunded this past year, which has caused us a bit of a crisis, trying to rally resources again. We've also seen advocacy as an important part of our work. Our third mission is to speak against use of torture in any circumstances. We would say it is never justified. We make the assumption that sometimes it's justified to get information. You all know the John Cain. Do you know the John Cain story? John McCain, yeah, that's what I mean, John McCain. You know, that he was being tortured to come up with names of his partners, his troops, and he knew that it was going to get so severe he was going to have to give names. So he did. He gave them the names of the starting lineup of the Green Bay Packers. So yes, they got information, but was it reliable information? No. You know. It is never for information, or rarely ever. It's about power, and it's about disempowering other people, making them feel utterly dependent and helpless, is really what torture is about. And therefore, again, anything you can do to help build that sense of trust back in people, even if it's only I can share my groceries with you, is therapeutic in that sense. Last thing I'll end with, and if there's time, I'll throw in just a comment on one of the ones. Just interesting experience. As we developed, we said we want to go to the faith community and look for support, and went to many of them. I am actually, having been working for the Presbyterians, went to their committee and said, would you endorse our project, partly for funding, and so we can use your name when we go to other funding. The response there was, well, can you assure us that there will only be Christian counselors here to counsel these folks? Which, I say this not to badmouth the Presbyterians, but in some ways to say, you know, in the whole issue of spirituality, sometimes we need to look outside the church because it is not always there. It is not that same understanding sometimes. And in fact, I wish I had the opportunity to go back to the committee and say, we just had our 1,000th client. How many have you seen now as Christian counselors? So just that struggle with the church and difficult issues like torture and looking outside the church. The last thing I just want to put a word in is the issue of detention. It's become an incredibly important issue since 9/11 in particular. Before that, people, when they applied for asylum, could come to the gates of our country and said, I want to apply for asylum. As long as there was enough preliminary evidence, they would be released on their own volition to help prepare their case, often a year or two before their case would come up, and they could contact family and prepare their case. Now, since 9/11, the general practice is you are put in detention. Polite word for prison, because it is the same conditions as prison. They're put in with other criminal immigrants. You all probably know our Otay Mesa Detention Center right down here. It's incredibly complicated, the work we do. We used to be able to see people because they could come to our office. Now you have to make an appointment, and they're very restricted down there. Often the attorneys will go down and are made to wait 3 to 5 hours in the waiting room before they can see their client. And it is not unusual that without notifying anybody, they will move a client from here to New Jersey, even though all their attorneys and their family happens to be here. And it's made it really hard in some ways to be able to work in the intimate way we've been able to work with clients. So I'll stop there.
My question, Bill, starts with where you ended, and that is, of the 11,000 you estimate here in San Diego, are any of those persons, two questions, are any of those persons persons who have been released from state prison who experienced torture in our state prison system? And my second question is, has your understanding of torture or perspectives on torture changed since the revelation of U.S.-sponsored torture around the world?
First one is, no, we've not had cases to present of persons that have been tortured in our own prison system. We have heard stories of immigrants detained in detention centers before they're put in to something like Otay Mesa, you know, being made to stand in a place where they don't have any clothes on and are in the cold, and a lot of things that would border on that. But none of those have been treated as a case to bring before a judge in many ways. So just that's the first response. The other one, incredible shock in some ways. Suspicions were always there, but I guess just to have so much come out in such a relatively short period of time, when every statement by our president and others in those points said, the United States does not torture. You know, and then to have all that come forward. And that is the case. There are supposedly about 80 nations right now that openly practice torture. And the whole issue of rendition, we sometimes, Egypt has been one of those, where we send clients, because we weren't successful in interrogation. What that often means is they still allow torture, and we can send them over there. So that's one issue. But then there's another suspected 120 nations who use torture but don't acknowledge it and wouldn't approve it. And unfortunately, we fall in that category now.
Mm. It's interesting. I mean, I'm going to, I'm not sure, but I want to say something that it's interesting to raise that question, because the torture manuals for, as far as I know, my information, the torture manuals for Abu Ghraib were devised by personnel maybe stationed at Pendleton. which is San Diego. So, interesting.
Close to home.
Close to home, very close to home. Any other? If there are no questions, comments, reactions to what we hear from, what we heard from Elaine.
I would just like to say that I really appreciate and affirm that the work that you are all doing, all three of you, and it's what an honor it is to have you here and sharing your work and your stories, and through you we hear other people's stories. So I just wanted to thank you for your time and your gifts.
And I want to ask Mike, since he's still here, if he wouldn't mind sharing a little bit, because weren't you involved in the foundation of the whole process of this migrant outreach and just how that happened?
I wasn't involved in the very beginning. However, I did know people who were involved, so I'll probably, it's also in that video of Episcopal Chapel. They said there's three women at our parish. Father Frank was the pastor. He just recently retired in the last year and a half. And they said, hey, there's some men out here, and they seem to be hungry. So they said, well, we'll cook some food. And they were really, the migrants themselves were very shy. And so literally, when the ladies came up to them, they would kind of run off. And so they would just leave some food there on the hill, and then go away, and then by itself, we realized that they were, you know, friends of theirs, and eventually developed a trust, and then eventually got to know them a little better, and they were asking, hey, you know, is there a mass? Can we have mass? And so that's when it was brought up to our pastor's attention, and he decided to go out there in the middle of very early in the morning, like 6 in the morning. Get bread and other supplies donated, or bring some things very early in the morning, and out just beyond the housing projects or the new homes over there in Skias, just east of Del Mar. And there's some early pictures, they're black and white and movie, that people, a few of the members of the of our parish, and many of our men, some of them. Very young and or very old too, living in literally like under a tree, and you know, just maybe have a plastic sheet. And so we said, well, we can do a little bit more to assist these people, because they're literally in our backyard. They're members of our parish, being, you know, and part of our family. So our pastor, well, you know, let's try to organize something, and that's how it's basically become, you know, an organization. We have a team that goes out every month now. It's been going on for about 25 years. I did want to mention something about your comment, though, about another parish or another congregation being involved. We had a Jewish, the Jewish synagogue in Carmel Valley approached us. So, you know, we heard what you're doing, and we'd like to join you. Would that be okay? And so they actually became one of the teams that joined one of our teams for a whole year. And they came out, and it was a great interaction, and we were all working together. And then after that year, they moved on to something else. So if you haven't seen that movie, Invisible Chapel, you can, there's little clips on YouTube.
Thank you, Mike. Yes.
I'd like to ask both Elaine and Bill about your experiences, and perhaps, Elaine, your expectation in your moving in and out of the United States. What was that like for you, particularly the reentry, but also your expectation as you go back to Guatemala? Could you just say a word about what that feels like, what that was for you?
Well, I can very specifically respond to what reentry was like after living and working in Guatemala for 15 years. I really didn't want to leave, but I was not healthy and needed to leave. I was just too sad. And so I came here kind of kicking and screaming. So I've always said, you know, it did me good because I had an experience, even though I'm an American citizen and I have citizenship, so I speak the language and have all these education and advantages. I had some experience that psychologically was similar to that of a refugee. And so an immigrant. And so I really did have those struggles to readapt to my own culture, which seems odd, but I really did. And so I think as I'm approaching going back to Guatemala, I've not been able to just go. Like, I wasn't able to just buy a plane ticket and visit and everything. It took having colleagues here at the University of San Diego say, let's go do an exploratory trip to plan a class and go with my companions with whom I feel safe and comfortable here, re-engage, begin to see some folks there. And now I've made 6 trips, one every 6 months. And it's been those trips that have kind of opened up my heart to say, I really want to go back, and I'm psychologically prepared to go back more and more. And in fact, my energy is thinking that way. But I want to acknowledge Sister Barb, who is my director. She teaches spiritual direction here. And I was in her course for 2 years in a spiritual direction certificate program. And she knows how many of my papers had to do with this whole one. I was dealing with my past sadness from, you know, having essentially taken up what Bill was talking about, that even if you are not personally tortured, if you're not personally your family member killed, you receive enough of that stuff and it gets into your soul and you just, you know, you're carrying it. And so I had to undo some of that so that I'm actually ready. Let's see how I do. I'm holding onto a condo here, though. I'm going to escape. Oh.
In connection to what Elaine is saying, have you mentioned by any chance in previous days the documentary Killing Paradise? Killer's Paradise?
No.
So I strongly recommend watching Killer's Paradise, which has to do with the current situation of femicide in Guatemala. And that will give you an idea of how the state is dealing with civilians, with social movements in Guatemala and with civilian population, particularly with women. It's a very, to be prepared, it's a very dramatic film about what is happening to young women in Guatemala, you know, being killed by the thousands. So that will reflect somehow what Elaine is saying. So to go to Guatemala and to be prepared to live there, that required time for preparation.
The funny story is, we were 5 years in Peru. We land in Florida. Before Disneyland, which our kids wanted to get to, supermarket where we wanted to go get some things we hadn't gotten. I headed for the pickles. My boys said to me, "Can you get sugar cereal, Dad?" And that sugar cereal in 5 years. Sure, you go there. So I enjoyed getting my pickles and wandering around. Go to the boys. Here are these two early teenagers, quite literally in tears, in front of the cereal aisle, an entire aisle, saying, "Dad, we can't choose. will you choose for us?" And just to add to that, my wife and I recently came back from Thailand. We were visiting Heifer International and some of the programs they have there, and got to visit some of Heifer's work, a farmer who was prepared to become an immigrant. To leave there, probably go to the city and work in the city in Thailand. But Heifer came along and said, "We can give you animals to help you get an income to stay in your land." He was so pleased to take us around and show us his animals and to show us his garden and say, "I'm so happy because I can stay here with my family now and we have a good life." And I looked with him at what his lifestyle was like and what mine is like. And I said, "Now whose is the sustainable one?" And it is his. And so my wife and I, although we've got ties here and I don't see us leaving permanently here, we actually look for the opportunities to go get our spirits refreshed in a different culture and a different way to view the world and a different way to challenge our values in some ways. So that's got built into us from our travel experiences, I think.
Thank you. I just want to highlight for characteristics that I found in the sharing of Elaine in the Pastor Varas. What I find is that the first both panelists their experiences and thoughts have been influenced by situations of violence and destructive conflict. Second characteristic, they, together with their families and communities, have been creative and courageous enough to devise responses to violence and conflict in constructive ways. And third, they assert the fruitfulness of finding resources beyond Christianity. So taking the best from within our own Christian traditions, but also engaging in interreligious conversations, asserting the need more and more to opening up our scope of view to engage in interreligious approaches. The fourth element that I find in both of them is how they both assert how through their experiences of life, they have been fostering a spirituality of justice and liberation. Spiritualities of justice, commitment, liberation, service to the poor. So they have become religious actors who embody the best religious traditions of peacemaking.